As we begin this evening, we're in a study on the subject of between the testaments, sometimes called the intertestamental period. But what we're looking at is those great things that happened between the end of Malachi and the beginning of Matthew. This particular one is lesson 6, and the one that we hear quite a bit about, but generally we've not studied a lot about, is the Maccabean Rebellion. And we really introduce that at the end of the lesson because all the events that lead up to it show why that happened, what came together to make that occur. So here's between the testaments, the world awaiting Jesus. Well, if we're going to review a little bit, because if you're like me, I said, okay, now the next point, you say, yeah, we covered last week, and I think, and it gets lost, because there's so much material in this period. These are things you know, and I'll just be moving through them quickly so we get to new material. In Daniel chapter 2, and verses 31 through 35, here's a dream. Daniel interprets, what king has the dream? And the answer is?
Nebuchadnezzar.
Thank you for that volume. It was great. And so he has this dream, and he says, all right, here's what it is, king. You are the head of gold. Well, Nebuchadnezzar is the guy. For the Babylonians, they come down, capture the Jews, deport them, and repopulate Babylonia with them. Then here is the chest and arms of silver. And he interprets the dream, and here's Persia. And Persia then released the Jews, reversing Babylonian policy. And then the third kingdom was the Grecian kingdom, Alexander Macedonian, actually, but with Greek philosophy. And so what was interesting, we looked at it, he conquers the world in 10 years. Poof. He's Travis is an age and you're almost done. It's time. He's going to get a retirement, okay, but not the time kind he wish. And at his death, the generals divide up his empire. And so we talk about different ones, but as far as the Jews are concerned, the ones that have application for our interest is going to be one of the generals, Ptolemy the First, and he said, I'd like to take Egypt. And everybody said, okay, you can have that. And then Seleucus, came to be known as Seleucus the First, and that's kind of becomes a family name, and so a lot of times they'll have an identifying name, and so this was Seleucus I Nicator, and he got Mesopotamia and Syria and such as that. So these are the ones that are really going to be doing the fighting for the most part that we're going to be interested in. Daniel chapter 11 is going to look at this period of time. You say, why have it in a Bible study? Because it's a Bible subject. Here is the thing that Daniel prophesies about. Anyhow, what occurs in 198, so you're counting down toward the time of Jesus, so the years will be getting smaller and smaller. Antiochus the Third defeats Ptolemy. So here's family names. Ptolemies, they all had, the control of Egypt, and this particular one, Ptolemy the Fifth. And there's this battle we talked about last week, the Battle of Panium. It goes by a number of different names. And at this one, although Palestine had been the football kicked back and forth between Egypt's control and Syrian control, here in 198, it becomes definitive, and now Syria is the one that has control and will rule Palestine for the most of the next 150 years. And so here is that third kingdom of the belly and thighs of brass. And then the fourth kingdom that is seen, here's Rome rises, and we're going to see its rise. It's kind of, wow, look what it's doing. Because you just think, well, yeah, Rome's over there. They're minding their own business, and these countries are having the difficulty. But oh, no, I mean, they're just growing and becoming restive and more powerful as the years go by. And this is the world into which Jesus is born. Galatians chapter 4 and verse 4 said, in the fullness of time, he was born. And so at just the right time, you have all these major events, a Roman peace, travel, citizenship, things, universal, nearly universal language, Koine Greek, that made the preaching of the gospel easier in the various vicinities. All right. So we've looked at the Ptolemies last week. This week we're going to look at the Seleucid line, and because Seleucus was the general that got that. And so we look at this graphic, and it gives you a sense of, well, here's the Mediterranean, but by this time, 198, now they have control of Palestine and control of Syria and Mesopotamia, and they have a whole lot of control initially. And so as you look at that and get that ready, where we're going to be focusing on our interest, what happens in the little square of Palestine. So which ruler first established Syrian control over Palestine, and his name was, for 111 points? And I said, no. Antiochus, and what's his number? The third, Antiochus the third. And so that's where this kind of a earth-shaking event takes place from the standpoint of a Jew's experience. So here's Antiochus the third. Now he's noted as the great, but we're going to see later in life, you know, there's some things that's not so great about the life that he goes, well, here's Antiochus the not so great. But at any rate, at this time, he defeats Ptolemy the fifth at this battle of Panias that we mentioned. And now, since he's got Palestine, that kind of secures, that safeguards his southern border. While I'm busy causing mischief in other places, I don't want somebody sneaking up on me from the south. As a side note, everybody has heard of Hannibal. I go, yeah, across the Alps. Why? Because he's trying to get to the other side. Well, the reality is, the interesting thing, Hannibal has a part in this, and a part in what happens to Antiochus, and because of the advice he follows from Hannibal. But, you know, it's all in the will of God, that God rises up kings and he puts down kings, and Nebuchadnezzar need to learn that lesson, that God rules where? In the kingdom of men, that's right. And so, yeah, but look what's happened down here. And why did government do this? God's looking all over this. We just don't see the long range view. Anyhow, here's Hannibal. He was a general. Picture, and we'll look at some of the maps and geography in a bit. So here's North Africa. Here's Carthage to the west of Egypt on North Africa's coast. And what happened was there was a series of wars, three Carthaginian, and they're referred to as Punic Wars, maybe because there's not as much spelling involved. But at any rate, so here's this big battle. Rome is growing in power, and Carthage is growing in power, and they're rivals. And so what happens is General Hannibal's dad said, man, we're going to take over and do all this, and he dies, and that doesn't happen. So the son says, I'm the man. I can do it. And what I need to do, I've been being whipped by these Romans, I need to settle their hash. I'm going to take over Rome. If I rule Rome and I rule Carthage, I rule the Mediterranean world. And so the Romans thought, yeah, he's just going to sail across the Mediterranean from the north coast of Africa to the west coast of Italy, start a battle and go on. But you know that part of the story. That's not what he does. He sails way to the west, goes into areas not friendly to Rome, and starts a five-month journey on his way. I'm going to go up over the European Alps and down the back northern door of Italy, and that is in 218 BC. It is said that he started out with 30,000 infantry. And really what they do is estimate that the low end is 20,000. The high end is 40,000. So all right, you got 30,000 soldiers, 15,000 cavalry, 40 elephants. And by the time they get to the foothills of the Alps, they cross it in 16 days. But he's never done this before. He had never crossed. He's never talked to anybody that crossed. He's talked to some people that have seen it. But now you've got to get war elephants and 40,000 people over narrow little trails, and they're falling off the side, dying from avalanches and disease, this and that. And so what happens is not the best. He scores some great victories and faced ultimate defeat. And what Rome did is, you guys don't learn. And there was a great general, Scipio Africanus, and it's just brilliant. And just every time that you'd think, well, Carthage is going to win by Hannibal's rule, nope. And finally, General Scipio said to Hannibal, "It seems like you cannot tolerate peace. All right, then it's war." And so it went. And by the trials that Carthage went through, they tried to take the war to Rome. It didn't work for them. And then finally, Carthage was reduced not only to a vassal state. And they always had all these war stipulations and reparations, and you got to give all up all your warships except 10, which you got to turn to fishing boats or something. And you got to pay back Rome for all the money they spent fighting you when they didn't want to do it, but you caused it, so you got to pay that back. And then you can't raise an army, you can't make treaties unless we say you can, plus pay 10,000 talents of tribute every year. Well, man, now you're hammered and all this and that. And so Hannibal, that didn't work out well for him. So question number two was, Antiochus III, that is Antiochus the Great, now starts marching across Asia Minor. Who stops, I was almost going to say Hannibal, who stops Antiochus III, and that is? Yeah, it is Rome. They said, hold it, we got a problem, young man. We're just trying to be a friendly little nation here and take over the world. And what's happening is you're pressing us. You're making it uncomfortable for us. That from our standpoint, as long as China stays over there and does its own thing and doesn't threaten us and doesn't have intercontinental ballistic missiles in Korea, we go, yeah, whatever. Now they got 40 million ballistic missiles and, you know, 2 million man army, and we're alarmed. And so that's what happens to Rome. And from Antiochus's position, he inherited really a disorganized kingdom. And in a little while, various parts of his territory are breaking away. Bactria and Persia and Parthia. I said, well, you're busy over there. I think we're going to run our own affairs, and we don't want to take orders from you anymore. So he sets about to reconquer the territories that were originally his, at least ancestrally. Hannibal just doesn't learn. So there, he starts another conflict with Rome, and General Scipio then comes to Hannibal's backyard, and at the Battle of Zama in North Africa, beats him. 20,000 Carthaginians are slaughtered. 20,000 are captured. That really ended the Carthage's hope of ever being a world power. But Hannibal himself gets away, and he says, man, I got to get out of here. You know, I think I'm going to go a little further east. I'm going to hang out with, guess who? Antiochus III, because we seem to have a common enemy. Here's Rome threatening you, saying you shouldn't be moving through Asia Minor, and they're threatening us. You know, we're just trying to mind our own business and take over the world. And so what happens is Antiochus starts off across Asia Minor, and he has designs on going to Greece. Well, why is that? Because Hannibal, while he was hanging out, Antiochus III said, you know, we got a common enemy, and, you know, I'd help you out if you like. In fact, if you would like to go and liberate Greece, boy, I'll be with you. I'll help you out in this endeavor. And so Hannibal encourages Antiochus to go attack Greece, and that gets the Romans all excited. Say, wait a minute, that's our back door. You know, we'd be excited if China and North Korea take over Mexico or Canada, too close for comfort. And so the growing Roman Empire fights back, and what happens is they beat Antiochus in Greece at Thermopylae and chase him back, and they get him over to Asia Minor, and as they're there, he's at Magnesium, and they crush him there. So question three was, what's the result of the Roman-Syrian war? And the result is what? What happens to Antiochus, who I'm trying to take over the world. I know Hannibal was, but you know, he's small potatoes. Rome is interested in it, but really, I've taken over Palestine. I tell Egypt who's who in the zoo, and actually, Asia Minor territories were mine, and my ancestors' homeland is in Macedonia. You know, like for me, I might as well conquer Britain and Germany. My ancestors lived in Hungary, so I should take over all of Europe. And so, well, wait a minute, maybe not. So what did Rome say to Antiochus III? That's a way to summarize it. You are not going to make it, partner. In fact, I'm going to whip you here in Greece. I'm going to whip you in Asia Minor. And Rome declared war on him and drove him out of Greece and gave him a shattering defeat at Magnesium, which is near Smyrna. So we're familiar with Smyrna because it's one of the seven churches of Asia. And so that was 190 BC. Now in Daniel chapter 11, in verses 18 and 19, talks about that very event. And God's telling him, look, 200 years in advance, 300 years in advance, I am telling you, there's a guy that's going to rise up and he is going to fall, and this is that individual. And so as a consequence of his international aspirations, Antiochus III must surrender all of Asia Minor, except little band of Cilicia down there in the bottom. His navy, all except for something, 8 ships. His son, Antiochus IV, that will eventually be called Antiochus Epiphanes. Oh, that guy's going to get a taste of Rome, being a hostage in Rome, and when Rome means business. Plus, you get to pay, one writer says, 450 tons of silver. So, man, you're being whacked financially. You're being whacked domestically. You got to give up your war elephants, and so militarily, and your navy, and you're humiliated. You got whipped every way you could possibly be whipped. And he dies. Think about this. He tried to overcome Rome, and it really took him about 4 years in the total battles, and he dies 187 BC, 3 years later. How? Isn't this ironic? Robbing temples in Persia to pay Rome. You go, oh my. Hannibal, you were useless. Antiochus the Great, you had great aspirations. That's what you had, great. But it didn't work out. What if they had just said, God, I'll do whatever you want me to do. I'm just going to mind my own business, stay in my own country. But that's not how they look at things. And so think about this. Here's the Roman Empire. Once it beat Carthage, that's Hannibal, in the first, second, and third Punic or Carthaginian wars, and they overcame the Macedonians in a series of wars, Rome became the master not only of Italy, but of Africa, of Spain, of Greece. Look in the position they now have. They have become not just a regional power, but a Mediterranean superpower. And they're not done yet. Remember that fourth kingdom in Nebuchadnezzar's dream? And Daniel said there's going to be a fourth one, unlike the others. It'd be great and terrible. All right, That moves us now down to question number four. Why did Antiochus the Fourth, so now Antiochus the Third has died, robbing temples. It seems kind of an ignominious death. And you say, hey, I've been robbing churches and I got killed in the process. Well, that's not a very glorious end. So here's his son, Antiochus the Fourth, which is now Epiphanes. The question was, why does he need to loot the temple in Jerusalem? That's right, we got problems, and the paycheck is shorter than the bills. And so here is the Epiphanes, and his rule was 175, 164. He's that son that Antiochus III had to turn over to Rome as a hostage, saying, I'll do what I'm told, and I'll keep my commitments. And he was there because of his father's failed conquest of Greece. Antiochus IV had to get the money somewhere. Where are you going to get it? Social Security wasn't making it. And dad got it by robbing temples. I might as well start robbing temples. And think about this. Tribute is those financial assets paid to a superior power for the privilege of not being slaughtered. That's really what it comes down to. It's like the mafia. All right, you're paying protection from me, or we break your legs and we shoot your dog and kill your family and burn your house and firebomb your donut shop and all those kind of things. And so that's what they do. That's how the empires work. You conquer the next country and crush them, take all the money you can out of them, and say, now you behave or we're going to come back, you know, and kill everybody in the village. And so Antiochus, the enlightened, the sparkling one, why, he's just doing the same thing. Then the question five was, why was Onias the Third? Now here's the high priest in the high priestly line. And the question was, why was he replaced? And the answer is, look, okay, now in his case, initially it wasn't money. He has a different issue. And he has an accusation out against him of not being loyal to the Seleucid government. Now, it's going to come down to money in just a little bit because it always comes around there. But it starts out in a little different direction. In these apocryphal books, that they're historical books, kind of written by we don't know who, and First Maccabees is generally better than Second, and sometimes they agree and sometimes they don't, and so you don't really know some of the details. But anyhow, Second Maccabees chapter 4, 1 and 2 says, and you can go online and read it, and you just type in those specifics. Simon, who was an informer for the Antiochus government, slandered this high priest named Onias. And what he said of him is he's a schemer against the government. But the reality is, Maccabees says, this man who was the benefactor of the city and a zealous defender of the law, his only crime is, I want to do what God says. I'm not saying overthrow the government. You know, we should all become Carthaginians or something. It's like Christians. That we don't necessarily agree with the government, but we're not saying overthrow it. You just be a faithful Christian, do what God says, and so forth. Now, that's what he was accused of, though, of being anti-government. You know, like Jesus was. You say you're another king, and you're against Caesar, and don't pay taxes. It was just lies. 2 Maccabees chapter 4, verse 7 to 9. Quote, in an interview, Jason promised the king 460 talents of silver. By the way, who's Jason in relationship to Onias? Yeah, here's his brother, his own brother. So now, since, well, my brother's kind of being kicked out by the governor, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk to Antiochus, and I'm going to solve your financial problems. And I will bring you every year 460 talents of silver, 80 talents from another source of income, so says 2 Maccabees. Verse 9, besides this, he would undertake to pay 150 more talents. And if he were given authority to establish a gymnasium, and look at this, and a youth center, doesn't that sound like a nice community active thing to do? And for it to enroll Jerusalemites as citizens of Antioch. Well, Jerusalem's in Palestine. Antioch's in, up there in Syria. Why, you come here, bring your young people here, we're going to play basketball, we're going to teach them to use computers, and you can roll and have dual citizenship, and all you got to do is pay $100 and sign your bingo card or something like that. And so it's a way of getting money. King, I can do it for you. And so sure enough, there is, he changes. All right, we're going to kick the last guy out, and we're going to put Jason in. Well, question number six is, why is that significant? Why is a, because you had, you always have high priesthood changes for one reason or another. Why is this one significant?
It deviates from the law.
Yes, you have a civilian governor countermanding what should be a religious consideration. And now you're telling the God's people who should be high priest. Wow, look at that. And supposedly, this is a representation. So this is the first time a civil government viewed it as their right to make changes in the Jewish high priesthood. Jason, although brother to Onias III, in distinction to him, was aggressively Hellenistic. And his appointment outraged the non-Hellenistic Jews. It's just like, which is the best president? All right, everybody stand up for this one. Yay! How about, what about you guys? That one's terrible. We, for this one, we go, that is worse than that. And somebody else said, both of you guys, everybody has their political opinions and craziness, because this one is way left and the lefties like that. This one's way right and the righties like that. This one's in the middle and all the middle ones like that. And everybody, wait, there's no new thing under the sun. So Jason now is high priest. And he's the guy that says, you know what, I can get you some extra money. We're just going to put in a gymnasium, have everybody run around naked. It's fine if we all speak Greek. Change the customs and such as that. So it's driving people crazy. But then Jason meets his match. He gets replaced by Menelaus. Now, the question is, why? We just got a guy promising the king, man, I'm going to double your paycheck. I mean, you want money? I am going to bring you the dollar bills. Now, let me ask you, if we had a president, whatever your political party is, if he says, I'm just as good as every other candidate, in fact, better than the other candidates, and I will make it easy on you and double the money in your paycheck, who'd you vote for? You're just as good as that one? Okay. Why? Because, wow, here, Jim said, well, down, well, maybe so. So why was Jason offered Antiochus a significant income? Why is he replaced by Menelaus? And the answer is, yeah, there was more money. So I give you more than he gave. But how that came about is really interesting. Menelaus is going to offer a larger bribe, but really our workbooks can't put all of this in, or it'd be 42 pounds and nobody could afford it and you wouldn't read it anyhow. But as you research some of the original documents and find out why they did that, from my standpoint, it's fascinating. Other people say, well, who cares why they did it? They just did it. And next, I always like to know, yeah, they did it. But, oh, why? Here's why they did what they did. In 2 Maccabees chapter 4, verses 23 down through 27, just to kind of summarize, it says, 3 years later. So Jason has been a high priest for 3 years. He really kind of ousted his brother. But now you've got stuff to do. You got to take care of your high priestly stuff. You got to take care of your bribes with King Antiochus. And maybe there's other final negotiations to make. And so he sends the brother of Simon, the informer who lied about his brother. So now you're going to use that crooked guy's brother as your reliable emissary to talk to the king and settle dollar amounts. And so here's the money I promised you. Fair enough. He does that. Verse 24, 2 Maccabees 4 says, but after his introduction to the king, he flattered him with such an air of authority that he secured the high priesthood for himself, outbidding Jason by 300 talents of silver. I tell you what, I'm just a mail carrier, but you know, king, I got a way better deal. Well, okay, you give me more money, I'm good for it. And so the king puts this guy in. Well, that is notable for a number of reasons. 2 Maccabees says of him, nothing made him worthy of the high priesthood. And I just put in a little note here, being of the tribe of Benjamin, he's not even a Levite. He's not even in the right tribal line. And 2 Maccabees says, and he had the temper of a tyrant. So, verse 26, Jason, who had cheated his own brother, now saw that he himself cheated by another man. Menelaus, who obtained the office, paid nothing of the money he had promised to the king. I mean, they're all a bunch of crooks. I'll pay you triple. And the reality is you don't pay him anything. Just a bunch of double-dealing, lying. I mean, that's the way government is. Oh, yeah, I'm all for you, you dirty liar. And hey, you want to make a deal out in the back door and meet you out in the parking lot kind of thing. All right, question number 8. Describe the looting of the temple by Antiochus IV. Those are epiphanies. What kind of things did he do in the looting of the temples? Such as, Marianne? Yeah, everything there is to take, I'm going to take. So you go home tonight, you say, man, I thought I locked the front door. You go in, they took the rugs, they took the wallpaper, they took the lights, they took your pots and pans. Mary?
Even the gold plating on the outside of the temple.
Oh, yeah, take everything. We're going to take the siding on your house. We're going to take the windows out. I mean, all you got, we take the sheetrock. All you got left is the studs. I mean, he cleaned house. Now, what happens is Antiochus has a plan. They always have a plan. I've got my little kingdom and I should have everybody else's too. So meanwhile, what I'm going to do is, since I don't currently have control of Syria, I have control of Syria and parts of Mesopotamia, I'm going to now, and I've got control of Palestine, I'm going to move down into Egypt. I should be kingdom of both countries. And so he actually makes two ventures. Let me just say this as a note. From the standpoint of 1st and 2nd Maccabees, there is a chronological challenge that the scholars don't know how to solve. One seems to say, everybody agrees that Antiochus Epiphanes made two trips into Egypt, but did these events happen on trip one or trip two? They argue about it. On one hand, it doesn't matter because they all happen at one time or another, but just so you know, there's some background argument on this. Anyway, 1 Maccabees 1:23 talks about what he took. I mean, he just took everything. He took the altar of incense and the lampstand, and he took the table of showbread. He took all the vessels, and he took the stuff off the front of the walls. I mean, just everything worth taking is what he took. And so as you look at that, there's one particular piece of furniture missing. I specifically have and is cited the altar of incense, the golden candlestick, the table of showbread, and all the vessels. What major part of religious furniture is missing? The Ark of the Covenant. What happened to the Ark of the Covenant? It was taken in Babylonian captivity, but it didn't seem to be among the things that were located when Jews were released by Persia. And so it's just interesting. We think about that and, well, if you didn't have it, then in Solomon's time, they had it, but in you don't got it, then Jesus didn't have it. They didn't have it after that. They had the Holy of Holies, but it doesn't appear that the Ark was there. Just interesting side note. Question 9 was, how did Antiochus look on, so here's Jason that, I'll say, engineered his brother's ouster, Onias III, and then he himself got booted out by his own emissary, Menelaus. Well, what happens is Jason tries to get the high priesthood back, and he goes into it. Well, when he does that, how does King Antiochus Epiphanes think about Jason's religious efforts? Yeah, oh, look at you, boy. I put this other guy in because he's paying me more money. Now you're trying to sneak around. And so what happens is, here's a little side note. It was reported that, see, Antiochus is down there in Egypt, and he's trying to make gains by being a king over two kingdoms. And there's always rumors. This happened, that happened, and whatnot. And you don't have online cameras and live reporting back from the battlefront and so forth. Antiochus was reported as dead on this second attack of Egypt, but it was incorrect. He actually had not been killed. But Jason then thinks, well, since the last king's dead and he's the one that allowed Menelaus, and I really am of the Aaronic line, it should be me. So he goes and he starts this attack. Fighting breaks out. Menelaus hides in the citadel of Jerusalem, and 2 Maccabees chapter 5, verse 5 through 10. What happens is Antiochus hears this, and just like what was Mary said, that Antiochus is, you know, alive and well. The rumors of his early demise have been greatly exaggerated. He's still breathing and living and so forth. And so what happens is he sends his troops to cut down the rebels. And they tell him, look, here's what I want you to do. 2 Maccabees 5. You cut down unsparingly everyone, the young and the old, the women, the children, the girls and the infants are butchered. At the end of 3 days, 40,000 were killed in fighting, and 40,000 sold into slavery because Jason wanted a position. Wow. Now, here's a little thing that is referenced in passing in our workbook, but is one of the really cool stories. Antiochus wanted to rule the land he had, Mesopotamia, Syria, and Palestine, but he also wanted Egypt. And on his first time he goes down to attack them, he really takes in all these forces, chariots and elephants and cavalry and so forth, and really overcomes the major cities. But he doesn't want to alarm Rome and get them excited, all right, we're going to attack you. So what he does is he leaves the pharaoh in place, kind of. He said, but now you're answerable to me. So you're no longer an independent nation, and just mind your P's and Q's, and I'm the boss. Well, that's fine. That's the first attack. The second time, he goes down there again. And in this time, he is met by a Roman envoy named Gaius Lianus. And so you think, well, man, I'm going to control everything, except here's what you have is a single elderly Roman ambassador. And he says to Antiochus, who would be the guy kind of in the center there, the message from the Senate was to withdraw his armies from Cyprus and Egypt, or consider himself in a state of war with Rome. What does Antiochus say? He said, well, I will discuss it with the council. Gaius says, he takes his staff and he draws a circle around Antiochus. He said, I will have your answer before you leave the circle. Whoa! If you move out of that circle and you don't surrender, you're at war with Rome. If you surrender, all your hopes of ruling Egypt and world conquest have just vanished. What does Antiochus do? He surrenders, steps out of the circle, and then Gaius shakes his hand. So Here's the plan. All right, I'm going to conquer. I'll be everything. Well, Dad didn't make it, and Hannibal didn't make it, but I'm going to. No, you're not. You're not going to make it. So when Antioch is infuriated now, and here is Jason trying to take over, and I got all these anti-Hellenistic Israelites thwarting my purpose, and so I'm going to attack Jerusalem. And he has his troops attack on Saturday, and the reason is why? Jews aren't going to fight on Saturday. That's why they made terrible Roman soldiers. They try to get them in the all right, and the infantry, they said, okay, we'll march, you know, Sunday through Friday. Well, Saturday, we're going here. No, we're not doing that. And so they made terrible soldiers, and they included people from all kind of lands, but not Jews. And they just wouldn't fight on Saturday, and the reason was why? It's work, and Exodus chapter 31, verse 15, for instance, says, for 6 days, work may be done. But on the seventh day, there is a Sabbath of complete rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day shall surely be put to death. That's what the law was. Well, what happens is they find out, you know, that's not working very good for us. You know, we get tens of thousands of us slaughtered. And so they make a new law. They said, okay, if you're attacked, you can fight back. But they've not done that yet. And so question 11 was, why did Antioch the IV persecute the Jews anyhow? Why was he trying to enforce all this Hellenism and these false gods on them? What was his purpose behind that? Yeah, there's the thing. See, what helps me, if I just see people doing nutty things, and I don't know why they're doing nutty things. Well, they're nutty people. But if I can say, here's why they're doing that. Got it. That's why they're doing that. Because this ties to that. And so you see Antioch Epiphanes has a problem. He's got to pay reparations to Rome. He thought, hey, that's fine. I'm going to conquer Egypt and I'll have more money. In fact, I may be strong enough to say, Rome, mind your own business and I'll have plenty of money and it's not working and my own kingdom is in tatters. And so, all right, I've got a problem. I'm going to solve that problem. He's attempting to unify the kingdom. And that wouldn't be possible as long as you have the Orthodox Jews with you. So, all right, we're going to change what's Orthodox. What is Orthodox is now eating pigs and worshiping Zeus and don't obey the Sabbath and don't circumcise and don't follow the law, and then you're going to be a good citizen. So question 12 was, how did he persecute? What are some of the things he said that we're going to make a change for you Jews, and we're all going to be the same unified religion. So what are some of the things the Jews could no longer do, at least by law? A little louder? You cannot offer sacrifice at all. What else? Yeah, no circumcision. You can't observe the Sabbath. You can't follow your festivals. All these things that had been so crucial to your religion, that is, the holy place will be profaned. You're going to worship idols. Pigs will be sacrificed. Circumcision is not only forbidden. If you circumcise your child, we'll kill you. Copies of the Bible will be burned. Everybody that is disobedient to the law is going to be executed. Wow. And so how did that play out? You're looking at a picture of troops in the courtyard of the second temple. And you recognize there's the altar. But here's the oddity about it. What is just behind the flames? There's a Larry, what is that back there? That is a statue. Now, the altar of Zeus or Jupiter, depending on if you're Greek or Roman, is set up on the altar of God in the temple. That's what the Jews saw. Now, I'm going to share with you that verse that I have shared 100 times, I guess. It's among my very favorite. As we come over here, to Daniel chapter 11, verse 31. Daniel says, so here's Daniel in the 500s talking about the 200s, so now it's 300 years in the future, and forces from him will arise and desecrate the sanctuary fortress and do away with the regular sacrifice, and they will set up the abomination of desolation. 300 years in the future. Here is this rotten, no good idol, and it's just going to desecrate everything. And here's the verse that I quote so often. And by smooth words, he will turn to godliness those who act wickedly toward the covenant. Bunch of the Jews say, you know what? We'd be a lot better off. What if we just go along with the thing? I mean, our income will increase. We'll have less persecution. We'll advance in society. We're going to be accepted in other parts of the world. They have all these reasons. There's only one problem. They're not God's reasons. But the people who know their God will display strength and take action. That's the background to that verse that I quote 100 times. It applies to us. Right? Well, it's so hard, and society says, and I feel like, and everybody else is doing this or that. Here's what God has to say. If there's a challenge that I have, I need to display strength and, number two, take action. And that's how it's going to play out here in these last two slides that I have. So question number 13 was, who were the Hasidim? That's just the plural of Hasidic. So who were the Hasidim? Who was this group of religious nuts? Yeah, they're the pious ones. Everyone says, wait a minute. If that's what God says, then I'm all in. Yeah, but Antiochus says, good for Antiochus. Let me tell you what God has to say. Now, people will do that in religion. They say, well, Mike, what do you think about baptism? Don't you feel like it would be awesome? Look, instrumental music. I mean, see, to me, I look at it, and how do you feel? What do you say? You say, well, actually, we all have different feelings, but what if we just go to the Bible? And you go to the Bible, and let's see what the Bible has to say about it rather than our own feelings. So here were the pious Jews, the most rigid adherents of the law, a Jewish sect that emerged right at this time between 300 and 175. Now think about it. You've seen them. They exist today. They just dress differently. There's the modern Hasidic Jews. Well, why do they wear black? Because in Poland, they used to wear black hats and black coats. That's why they're doing, you know, fiddle on the roof. Tradition. Does God say if you're a Jew, you got to wear a black hat? No. And then, you know, Mosaic law, you know, you may not cut the side locks of your forehead. So they got these 2-foot long sideburns that just looks anyhow. But the ancient Hasidim, the Hasidic Jews, led the resistance against the influences of Antiochus IV. Antiochus, the Epiphanes, the God on earth. He was the first one to accept a title kind of referencing deity. So here's the last one I'm going to deal with tonight. What sparked? So here's all, we looked at all these influences and Antiochus III and Hannibal, and here's Rome, and here's what's happening in Egypt, and Antiochus IV, Epiphanes. What was the spark that touched it off? Yeah, there you are. And now for 200 points, from what city was Matthias? A little town, a rural city called Modin. And so what happened was embassies are sent throughout Judah to try to get these civilians to get on board with the program. And so, you know, like you have people from time to time I can't remember the name, I was going to say Dog Catcher Society, Animal Welfare. Hi, how you doing? Have you got license for your dog? I'm just here to help you out and get your money and get that dog tag on there and so forth. So they're just trying to help the citizens, you know, be respectful and so forth. And so they happen to come out here, and here is the Matthias is an elderly priest in this little town called Modin. You'll get an idea. You can kind of see Jerusalem sort of in central Palestine, and you picture the Mediterranean there to the west. Well, in between the Mediterranean coast and Jerusalem is this little rural village called Modin. And so they want to have, all right, we've come to your village. We're going to show you what to do. Here we got this little pagan altar. And Matthias, you'll be the first one. And Matthias says no. Matthias says no, but there's a timid Jew that's willing. He said, well, you know, I don't want to get Antiochus mad at us. And so he's willing to sacrifice. What does Matthias do? Man, that is your last timid act. And so what he does, he kills that timid Jew who tries to sacrifice and kills the representatives of Antiochus too. And what you have is the spark that begins the Maccabean rebellion. Maccabean suggests the idea of hammer because the tactics of Judas and his five sons and then the individuals that were willing to resist the Hellenizing pagan influences would hide out in the hills, come down, attack the forces. Very, very effective when you're fighting a numerically superior force. And so Matthias and then Judas the hammer and each of his five sons were leaders. You know, when we think about ourselves, that we're just children of God doing the best we can. But your influences encourage somebody else to be the kind of child of God that they ought to be. And so your influence lives on in the lives of others, as did theirs. Next week, that's where we'll pick up. Thank you so much for participating, whether at home or here in the auditorium.